I will call the hybrid meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee for April 27th to order. This hearing is taking place pursuant to Rule 10.01 and can also be viewed through the House webcast. Ms. Anna, please take the roll.
Chair Moran.
Present.
Vice Chair Olson.
Present.
Representative Garofalo.
Present.
Representative Albright.
Good morning.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Present.
Representative Bernardi. Excuse. Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen, excuse. Representative Hassan.
Oh, shut up.
Present.
Representative Hertas, excuse. Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein, present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Kreshaw.
Kreshaw, present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Mariani. Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Miller.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski, present.
Yes. Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Schumacher.
Present.
Representative Schultz.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Yep.
Representative Sundin.
Sundin, present.
Representative Johnson. And Representative Mariani. Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
So a quorum is present. Our first agenda item is approval of the minutes from our previous hearing. The minutes were provided in members' packets and posted online. Representative Olson, can I get a motion to approve the minutes for April 22nd, 26th, 2022?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we have the motion before us. All in favor of the minutes say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So we have four bills on the agenda today, the Health and Human Service Omnibus and the Tax Bill. Of course, if we don't complete all the bills before 10:45, we will be called back at 1, or either the call of the chair. The staff will provide updates on the timing. So given recent floor activities in the Health and Human Service bill that we see before us, that is a good, healthy read. We need to revisit the budget resolution. So, Vice Chair, can you please take the chair and the gavel?
Bring the 2022 budget resolution coded BUD Res 04-01 as amended yesterday back before the committee. Chair Moran, please proceed.
So, member, as session goes on and we continue to respond to the change in events and additional information to help inform our overall budget picture, this amendment reflects that reality. So I would like to move the BUD Res 04-102 amendment.
Proceed, Chair Moran.
So this amendment, the A2 amendment, does two things. It increases the total general target by $575,497,000 to account for the increased general fund costs for the UI and the frontline worker bill passed on the floor on Tuesday. And the second thing it does, it establishes a net negative health care access fund target of $16,831,000. This target is the net effect of the reinsurance bill, which spent $53.4 million from the fund in the Health and Human Service bill, which put $70.2 million back in the fund. Ms. Adrian, do you have anything else to add?
Ms. Adrian.
Madam Chair and Chair Moran, the only thing that I would add is that these changes are reflected on the document, the House Budget Targets document. And so the total net spending is now 7.9 billion, just a little bit over, and this number reflects the $575 million change that Chair Moran referenced. And then I also just want to make note, under the general fund balance calculation towards the bottom, there is an added line there that's titled Revenue Replacement Repeal. So Senate File 2677 repeals a transfer that was to the general fund. So because of the language, now we reduce that same amount in fiscal year 23 of $633 million. And I think that's it, Madam Chair.
Chair Moran, anything further?
No, Madam Chair.
So the A02 amendment is before us. Are there any questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize if I'm not reading this amendment correctly, but when we did UI, Madam Chair, we're taking some money from the federal money, and I don't see that allowance because you explicitly did not allow, disallowed that. So are we making that change as well? I'm just not seeing it in the amendment. Am I missing something?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Adrian.
Ms. Adrian.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the budget resolution only reflects general fund. Well, I shouldn't say that. It reflects general fund, and then it does reflect some of the other funds. So we do not have the ARPA fund reflected in that, and we probably should add that. So we can make that change soon as well.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I think it's, since we did make that huge change on the House floor, Madam Chair, we definitely need to reflect it in the budget target so that it's explicitly allowed. Because do we need to do an oral amendment or something just to bring it into a line?
Chair Moran, do you? I'll defer to fiscal staff. Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, just a clarification that the state fiscal recovery federal fund target of $0 applies only to the omnibus bills. So because Senate File 2677 was not an omnibus bill, it's actually okay for the resolution to still have a zero target for the omnibus bills themselves.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Chair. I just want to make sure that we are explicitly allowing. So if that's how that works, then I'm satisfied. I just want to make sure we've got all of our I's dotted and our T's crossed. Thank you.
Further discussion to the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, the A02 amendment is before us, and we will proceed with a vote. All those in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay.
No.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members. So the last budget bill to assemble is a Health and Human Service omnibus, which will include three different budget proposals. One, it includes House File 4579, which is a human service bill from Chair Schultz. House File 4706, which is the health bill, Chair Liebling, and Articles 1, 2, 3, and 4, of House File 4735, which is the early childhood budget by Chair Pinto, which we heard last week. Chair Schultz and Chair Liebling has assembled their bills under a combined budget target. And since the Senate companion to Chair Liebling's omnibus bill was referred to us from the floor yesterday, Senate File 4410 is the bill that will be used as the vehicle. At the request of nonpartisan staff, we are using a delete all amendment that merges these bills to ensure the appropriation article is correctly drafted. So nonpartisan staff has provided a resource list on items included. We also have a combined spreadsheet from Mr. Burge where the provisions are color-coded by committee. They've done a very, very thorough job here for us. We will proceed directly to Senate File 4410 and let all three of our chairs discuss their portion of the bill once the amendment is before us. And so, Chair Liebling, I'm going to let you direct the presentation, but first, we need to make some procedural motions. Chair Liebling, would you like to move Senate File 4410 to be recommended for placement on the General Register?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, I believe you also.
Yeah. And then, Madam Chair, I also move to delete the language in Senate File 4410 and insert the contents of the House companion, House File 4706, the first engrossment. And that would just get the House language before the committee, and then we would do the DE after that.
Perfect. So, right, this motion just gets the House language before the committee. Any questions on the Liebling motion? So all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. Chair Liebling, please move to delete everything amendment and tell us what it represents.
All right. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much. So just so members are clear, thanks. So I move that the DE1 amendment, which is before the committee for Senate File 4410, DE1 amendment, and that's the very large pile of paper that members in the room here have before them. And I also have an author's amendment to the DE1, but before I move that author's amendment, I guess, Madam Chair, I just would like to kind of make sure members understand what you explained already, and that is that this procedure is a little bit different because of the difficulty for staff. And by the way, we have amazing, amazing nonpartisan staff. I know everybody knows that. And this is a very, very large and complicated bill, as the HHS bill always is. And so just for ease of processing, they have already combined the bills for us. So what you have in the DE is the Health Finance and Policy Bill, the Human Service Finance and Policy Bill, and we had a shared target. There was a sub-target for homelessness, which is, and the so the provisions from Chair Gomez and her subcommittee are also in the bill. And then the provisions from Chair Pinto's committee that pertain to human services are also in the bill. So this is combining the bills right here in the DE. They're already combined. Great. So, Madam Chair, with that, I also have the A2 amendment, which is the author's amendment to the DE1.
Correct.
And I would like to move that.
Are there any questions on the A2 amendment to the DE1?
Madam Chair, maybe I should explain that one.
Can you explain it, please?
Yes, I will certainly do that. So in spite of all our work, so first of all, I want to make it very clear, the DE1 that's before you is not exactly the same as the bills that left committee because, of course, in the process, we tried to fix the technical pieces, make the changes that members ordinarily make in author's amendments. But even so, with a bill this large, we always have many changes that get discovered. We asked members to check their bills, make sure that what they thought was going to be included was included, and things like that. So in spite of all the work that was done to get the DE1 here, we still have an author's amendment. It's not all that extensive in the scheme of things, but it does add a few little pieces and take out some pieces. So there's a, not to go deeply into depth here, because honestly, we could be here for days if I did that, but one key issue is there's a birth certificate provision that is being removed by the author's amendment, and there are some other little additions and subtractions, many of them technical. So with that, Madam Chair, I guess I would ask to adopt the author's amendment, the A2.
All right, thank you. So are there any questions on the A2 amendment to the DE1? Seeing no more further questions, the A2 amendment is before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. All right, the motion prevails. So the DE1 as amended is before us. Chair Liebling, I think, if you have any more you'd like to explain?
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, if I could, I think you should maybe speak to the bill just a little bit.
Okay.
And kind of I'll more speak about my portion of the bill, and then I know Chair Schultz wants to speak just a little bit about hers, and just to kind of tell you all what we're doing or trying to do in this bill that's before you, and I know members are going to read every word. And, anyway, we feel that this is a bill that helps to position Minnesota for success in the future. I mean, we are a great state, but we still have some real serious problems that are going on in our health and human services areas. We have, as we know, we're a very healthy state, but we have huge racial and ethnic disparities still. And this is of concern to all of us because as we go forward, more of our population is in these communities. And if we're going to be a healthy state, we really need to make sure that everybody gets a good start. So there are provisions in this bill that improve access to health care, that reduce disparities. We focus a lot on getting lead out of our drinking water, which is something that affects many people across the spectrum, but it particularly impacts low-income communities. We have a whole section in the bill trying to get our arms around pharmaceutical costs, which are something that everybody is or should be concerned about. I probably don't need to tell you any stories about that, but just the other day, I was standing in a line at a pharmacy. I watched an elderly man walk away without his prescription because it was $500. It's just heartbreaking to see that, and it goes on every day, over and over. And we have many provisions in this bill to help pregnant moms and kids get off to a good start, which is, again, I think a really shared concern that all of us have. Because that's our future. We also have many provisions in the bill dealing with the healthcare workforce, which is, again, we saw during the pandemic that, and a lot of this wasn't really the pandemic either. We know that demographic change has caused a lot of our workforce issues, and they cover, they're across the spectrum. We all know this. But it's especially acute and concerning in the healthcare space where more of us are older, more of us need care, and the workforce isn't going to be there unless we really focus on that. So that is also in the bill. And with that, I'm going to just stop and let Chair Schultz do some talking. Okay. Thank you, Chair Madam Schultz. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So this bill is another historic investment caring for the people across our state. We had made really large investments last year. We're doing it again, even though it's not a budget year. We have a surplus. And the needs of people, especially our most vulnerable, do not stop just because it's not a budget year. So we're trying to address those needs. And also a priority on our committee this year that was universal was to address the healthcare workforce shortages that we're seeing. So we're coming out of a pandemic, but we're also seeing these historic shortages really across industry, but it's very important to address these in healthcare because people depend on caring professionals for their lives. So this is very urgent. So we have provisions in here to provide relief for workforce shortages, temporary and long-term, to increase the pipeline of individuals going into the caring professions. We have provisions to increase reimbursement rates for the elderly waiver program. We're increasing PCA wages by over 10%. These PCA wages have not kept up with inflation, even though we increased them last year. There's still more work to do because we still have 13,000 openings for PCAs across the state. We are investing in behavioral health. We've seen a huge increase in the need for behavioral health therapy, therapists across the state. We're making those key investments. And in Chair Gomez's committee in preventing homelessness, we're putting money into ESP and homelessness shelters, something that we see a great need for across the state, not just the metro area. So members, this is a really good start to making these investments in the people of our state, in the families and loved ones of our most vulnerable, and in those who care for our most vulnerable. This is just really the start of something that we've been working on. And I know our bill is large, but it's large because there are so many needs across the state that we're trying to address. So members, I'm willing to stand for questions on the DE that's been amended with the author's amendment.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Chair Pinto, do you have anything you'd like to just add?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I previewed the full early childhood bill, including the HHS provisions, so we discussed them last week. I guess I'll just note now just how integrated, as Chair Liebling referenced, how integrated these different sections are. Chair Liebling had highlighted all the efforts we're making in her section of the bill to get kids, as she said, off to a great start, protecting them from lead, which is just awful for developing brains. Home visiting, a number of provisions, and then Chair Schultz was referencing the workforce shortage, and childcare we know is such a key element in the workforce shortage, and so I really appreciate the chance to work with them, and of course we'll be open to any questions members have, but otherwise we discussed the HHS parts of early childhood last week. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And I also like to just open up if staff has something that you'd like to add that. All right. Well, thank you. So are there any questions on the DE1 amendment? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, you'd mentioned PCAs and a 10% increase. Can you tell me how many PCAs approximately we have now in the state, and what is the fiscal cost of the 10% increase? And is that incorporated in one of the contracts that we've already passed through the SCR and then off the floor with the contracts bill?
Chair Schultz.
Thank you for that question. The PCA increase, like I said, is a little bit over 10%. I don't have the number in front of me, the number of PCAs that are currently working, but we can get you that information. And Doug Berg is with us, and he can tell us what the spreadsheet item is for the cost of the 10% increase. But anytime we increase reimbursement rates in any of our programs in human services, we have large tail costs, and that's why we have to do this incrementally, unfortunately.
Mr. Burge, welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Can you please introduce yourself and proceed?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Doug Berg. I'm with House Fiscal Staff. And I'll give you a slightly incomplete answer. I did this work yesterday for another member, asked the same question on how much we're spending on PCAs overall in this bill over the 3 years. The vast majority of that is the rate. There are two other small items regarding the allowance of driving and how many hours parents can be involved in. While I don't have the 10% number right off the top of my head, the total over 3 years for those is $102
million. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this isn't a fair question to ask fiscal staff, but you know, when we pass, I'll just ask Chair Schultz. So when we passed the contracts bill, we obviously did pretty standard increases. We do kind of a boilerplate thing. Do you know that if this still resides within the contracts that were passed, or does this, because I think we did like a 2.25 and 2.5, somewhere in that range, 2.5 and 2.5 maybe. So this is 10% over time. Is it still fitting in the parameters of the contracts bill that we just passed?
Chair Schultz.
I'm not certain about that question, but I do know that this is not part of the collective bargaining contract for PCAs, and that side of the, not all of them are in the collective bargaining unit. So they would have potentially the ability to open up that contract. But in terms of the overall for employee, I think you're, are you referring to the state employee contracts?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not sure how many are under AFSCME and how many are not. I do know we have 29,000, give or take, PCAs, because I do the contracts and the SCR and all of that. So I know that we have quite a few. I mean, that, you think about how many state employees we have, that's a big chunk. And so I think fiscal staff said $102 million, I think he said, was the overall cost. I'm not sure how much of that is an increase, but the increase would be helpful to know.
Anyone from my fiscal staff?
Let me just take another stab at that. So the PCAs, we have to increase reimbursement rates for them to get an increase in wage. And those increase in reimbursement rates go to the providers, and then they take that increased reimbursement rate. And we, in statute, says that 70 or a little over 70% of that increased reimbursement rate needs to go to wages and benefits.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think we'll get any further down the road, so I'll just leave it there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering, I believe this falls under Representative Schultz's purview, but could you point to the line item in the spreadsheet for an increase in the disability waiver services?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the DWS system, this is a system called the Disability Waiver Rate System, and we've done a lot of work in this area the past few years, and I'm just going to quickly go over what we've done.
Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I really just want to know the line item in here that increases the rate for disability waiver services.
Is there a fiscal staff who can help us point that out real quick?
Yep, let me explain that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. I will get to that question. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
So the end of banding came off in 2020. That was a 14.1% increase. We introduced a competitive workforce factor that's automatic. That doesn't need to be in the spreadsheet because it's an automatic increase. That was a 3.3% increase. We have a wage inflationary update. We increased the timing of that. We moved it up in 2022, and that was a 9.7% increase. So overall, the total increase in DWRS spending is 27.1%. This is compared to an average PCA rate impact of 12.47%. So we've done a lot more investment in DWRS over these last few years than in PCAs. They're separate. These are direct support professionals in DWRS, and PCAs are separate. So we're only paying $4.90 per 15 minutes in the PCA. This rate still is not fully funded compared to the DWRS system. It's 42% lower than the DWRS service system. So there's a lot more to do on the PCA side than on the DWRS side. And so we needed to prioritize, given our target, where we needed to put the money, where was the most need, was it neglected in the past. The other increase we made is in homemaker rate payments. And this had not been increased in 7 years. So we also put part of our budget target in increasing the rates for homemaker services, which helps prevent people going to nursing facilities, which saves the state money over time.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand what the legislature has done in the past, and I thank you for that review. But the point is there's nothing in this bill to address the disability waiver services. In fact, there was an amendment in the Health and Human Services Committee where they removed it by amendment. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I'm getting flooded in my email inbox from these folks. They work very, very hard. We have several systems within our Health and Human Services purview that are on the verge of collapse. And people can go work at Hobby Lobby and make more money for some really, really super hard work that they're doing. So it's a huge disappointment that there's, in this bill, there's $85 million for the MNCHR, or the MNCHR buy-in, or the MNCARE buy-in, one or the other, the MNCARE buy-in, and there's also another $85 million in here that's eliminating the cost sharing for public health care. But yet we can't seem to prioritize this disability waiver services, and that's really a disappointment. You know, one of the things that I always remember Chair Dean, Matt Dean, doing is he had this hierarchy of what priorities of our caucus would be when it comes to health and human services spending. And at the top of that was people with disabilities. And then specifically children with disabilities and adults with disabilities. And so to see that there's nothing in here in that regard is really a disappointment. Those are my comments, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I think I want to just say in a different way what I think Chair Schultz was explaining, and that is not everything has to be on the spreadsheet because it is happening by operation of law because of work we did in the past. So there is inflation built into those rates. Obviously, from the conversation here and for anybody who's listening, this is a really complicated way we fund this whole system. But PCAs also help people with disabilities. We've heard a lot about that in the past, and we haven't done that much for them. This is about, if you recall, sometimes we have people with severe disabilities who live independently, which is what we want people to be able to do, live the most independent life they would like to live. And in order to do that, they need assistance. And the people who help them have been very underfunded, and we are trying to do more there in this bill. So we have a whole system. This isn't about people with disabilities versus everyone else. We're trying to help people who live in different settings across the spectrum and who have different kinds of disabilities. So, you know, I think it's very unfair to say that we're not doing a lot for people with disabilities. Our state does more for people with disabilities than just about any other state, as a matter of fact. We all know that's very expensive. I think as Minnesotans, we want to do that service. We are proud of the fact that we do all of that. But just because it doesn't show up in a particular spreadsheet, it's because it's already built into the law and gets inflationary factor already. Now, does that mean that it's fully funded and we don't need to do any more? No, it does not. There is crisis all over this state in the workforce. In terms of, we know that there are services that are in crisis, but we are trying to make sure that the system as a whole is balanced, and we want to make sure that people can stay in their homes, as Chair Schultz was explaining, too, because that is less expensive. I mean, some parts of our system are more organized than others. Sometimes we know this as legislators, that we don't necessarily hear from everybody across the spectrum. We hear from the people who are the most organized. And I am not saying that they are wrong about their need. I'm just saying that this is not all people with disabilities. We are trying to fund the system in a way that a lot of the other services are not on automatic inflation. If we don't give them increases, they don't get increases. So we're trying to make this fair. The other thing I would say, before I give the floor back to Chair Schultz, and she tells me everything I got wrong here, or some of the things anyway. Now, of course, I forgot my other thought that I was going to say. But the reality is, too, that if you're saying that, you know, we often get a mixed message from our Republican colleagues. One is don't spend money. And the other is spend more money. And these are expensive services. There is no question about it. And as Chair Schultz said, they're very expensive in the tails. And we are spending a lot of money here, and we are doing our best to balance the system. And we will continue to do that because it isn't only people in group homes who need the service. That is one very important sector, but it's not the only sector. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Schultz.
We are doing a lot for vulnerable people in the state, especially vulnerable children. Many of our PCA services are for children that need those services. And we're also, you know, this we're giving the DWRS system a 10% increase this year. So it's not like we're doing nothing. We're doing something. That's significant. We're also trying to provide services for those group homes that may be at the verge of closing by having an emergency staffing pool, which we all voted for, the DFL, and passed off in the governor's sign. That's available. So we are trying to address the needs across the board. I don't know how you can say that we're not doing anything. We have a 880-page human services and health bill that's doing good things for people across the state. So it's really, I'm really offended that you say we're not doing anything when we spent our entire year in committee hearing bills that provide services for people across our state. So members, you know, just be assured that we are making key investments with our budget target in areas where we've heard there's a great need.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all of your explanation. And I understand that it's an expensive program and that this will go into the tails. And really, you know, I know you're saying on one hand we don't want to spend money, on the other hand we do. But we have priorities. And there are some things that have changed since the last year with the budget. And we've the problems within this disability waiver services, the problems within that industry have increased dramatically. And so I think it's there's no one more vulnerable than somebody with a disability that has to rely on other people to help them get through life. And we want to talk about the tails. This bill is $34.2 million, but by 2025, it turns into $889 million in the tails. So if this was a priority for the Democrats, there would not have been an amendment to remove it from this budget. There's nearly a $10 billion budget surplus. If we can't prioritize people with disabilities, then what are we doing here? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is like a nice chance to just make the committee that oversees fiscal issues be aware of something that I found out last spring when I was participating in the Commerce Committee, which is that, as Chair Liebling says, there's this automatic inflator in this area. There is not that sort of thing for low-income kids and families, for those who I'd argue who are the most vulnerable. And a significant part of funding in the tails in this bill is recognizing the needs for those families. So I simply want to make sure that we're aware that we have an automatic inflator in this area when it comes to a number of folks with disabilities, the elderly, et cetera, and not for young kids and families. I think that that's a double standard that we should not continue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this certainly health and medical issues are not my bailiwick. They're not something that I know a lot about, and the bill is reflective of something that's difficult for me to get through. But I know a couple years ago I was in front of your committee, Chair Liebling, and I had a request from a local intermediate care facility to have their reimbursement rate increased because they're not part of the at least they weren't at that time, part of any kind of inflationary increase. At that time, every intermediate care facility had to come before the legislature to get their reimbursement increased. And so at that time, it didn't fit within the budget and didn't happen. I understand that there was some increase a year or two ago for them. Is there a spot in here, or can you help me understand how intermediate care facilities are handled today and if there is an increase for them? Because my care facility in my area was getting half the reimbursement rate from another one just 50 miles away, and it seems that we ought to figure out some way of getting them more unified and uniformed as well in how we provide them, because the clients in those facilities are usually 100% bedridden. They don't have enough opportunity. A lot of people require intravenous work, et cetera, so they're really kind of the last step before full nursing home. So, you know, can you just help me understand where that is, how that's happening? Have we got that corrected where there's more equitable reimbursement rates? Thank you.
Who would like to take that?
Here, I will.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll start because, so Representative Petersburg, this used to be in my committee, and now because we changed the committees, it's actually in Chair Schultz's, but I'll start answering your question because I think it's a really important question. Thank you. And it illustrates exactly what we were just trying to explain to Representative Scott, which is there are other parts of the system, and they're not in the DWRS automatic inflated rate. So they're not getting anything. And, well, we did raise those rates across the board, I think, last year, and maybe Mr. Berg could give us the numbers on that. But we did make that increase before, and what we have in the bill now, and it would actually be in Chair Schultz's side, is a rate study, which we haven't had, for DHS to go in and look at all the facilities, exactly what you're talking about, to figure out what's going on there, which is a next step to us doing something more to actually set up a rate for them and set up something that they don't have to keep coming back with their hat in their hand to keep asking to please be included in the next budget, that there would be rates that would actually reflect the need there, that it's not so easy to get to that. We need to do some work and some planning, and that's what is set out in our bill. So I'm totally with you. I know that what you're talking about are these facilities, intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities. That's what they are. And it's something that probably most Minnesotans don't know anything about. I sure didn't before I came here. But they're kind of a little bit of a leftover type of care that is somewhat going away, I understand. But in the meantime, there are very vulnerable people who live there with high needs, and they're all over the state, and they're small, and they're sort of the stepchild, the forgotten stepchild. I hate to, all stepchilds, children are not forgotten, of course, but, you know. I don't want to get the angry emails on that one.
The people against stepchildren subpack is going to be contacting you later.
That's right, you got it. But anyway, these facilities do need attention, and that's what we're trying to do in this bill. So we gave them a rate increase across the board, which Mr. Berg could say exactly what that was. And then we're going to study the situation in hopes of putting them on the automatic pilot, just like the DWRS is now, so that we can get other parts of the system so that every person with disabilities is treated fairly and has the services they need. That's all of our goal, right? So, Chair Schultz, did you want to add something?
Chair Schultz.
Sure. So I agree that we need some more consistent reimbursement framework for ICFDDs. These are the facilities that Chair Liebling just mentioned. They used to have a rate framework that was cost-based, but Republicans froze those rates to balance the budget, unfortunately. So we need to, we take a look at different sectors, like the DWRS system. It was the Democrats who put in the inflationary increase. And we need to look at all of these different reimbursement areas and reform how we pay providers, so we're getting the best care to people across the state. You know, I'm open to looking at finding money in other areas to put in human services. If Republicans want to do that, maybe look at what we've just spent, billions of dollars on reinsurance in other areas. Happy to have those conversations with Republicans and how to direct it to human services.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you for that follow-up. And I think it is an important issue because there are winners and losers out there in regards to this particular field, because we have allowed that reimbursement rate to vary so far that it's making it much more difficult. And so I appreciate you working on that. And it sounds like for at least this period of time, these independent care facilities are going to have to deal with what they've got at currently. But I would also offer one more just piece of advice, and that is that sometimes when we want to figure out a funding issue, we don't always have to look at increased funding. We can also look at prioritization and whether or not we need to prioritize a little bit differently. That is always another option whenever you balance a budget. So thank you for your work on this, and I hope that in near future, the department and others can figure out how we can bring these reimbursement rates up into an equitable rate. Thank you.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm listening to this, I think this is the message that's trying to be conveyed to the Democrats on this. You're in the majority, so you're writing this bill, so we're conveying this message to you. As I was hearing these things, I hear about this is complicated, this is technical. I know that I'm not as smart as Representative Liebling. I know that I'm not as smart as Representative Schultz. And so when they tell me this is technical and here's why you need to understand this and understand that, I kind of go back to the well of what do I know, what I know. I have a special needs son, and so I not only have learned things through him, but that kind of places you into the special needs community. I have a wife who works at urgent care. And she has a lot of the people from group homes. It's just pragmatic that they go to urgent care. That's the practical way that they tend to go there. So we talk about these things. You can talk about how the formula is technical, that there's inflators, that if we do this, then we have to do that. I can tell you that my son will never understand this stuff. My wife, who is also, by the way, smarter than I am, okay, doesn't understand this either. Because we can talk as technical as we want. I can tell you the message that is coming from the people that we talk to is that the system isn't working and the care is faltering on these very vulnerable people. I can tell you that their care is not up to standards. And the people that want to care for them want it to be up to standards. We're not talking about someone saying, hey, we need a little bit of a pay increase. because we haven't gotten one in a while. We're saying they're telling us that their system is failing. I've heard stories. We kind of reference it as sort of like this imaginary thing. You hear people that are going to work for fast food because they can make more money there. My wife tells me there's people, and God bless them, by the way, they're going in and doing this work. But she says when she has care attendants bringing people into urgent care, sometimes she doesn't know which is which walking in. Now, I'm thankful for that help, but that tells me about the standard of care. I don't think you understand how serious this is. And the reason why I don't think you understand how serious it is because of what, and I think you probably lined item it out as a practical measure to make your numbers fit. Everything that we do about spending money numbers, I'm really getting worn out, by the way, of moral document statements, because that's a very tricky thing when you say that, because it's who's morals, okay? But let's go there. If you want to call this a moral document, this thing is falling short. When you guys go into conference committee, listen to the senators of what they're saying, because they're our voice when we get this final bill put together. Listen to what they're saying, because I don't think you're listening to what we're trying to say here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so we are on the DE1 amendment that we have not moved yet, but Representative Garofalo.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So. Somehow. 870, right? It's not a 870 pages. It's not a criticism of Representative Liebling, nor Representative Schultz. It doesn't take a lot of research to go back in time and see that when my side of the aisle was in control, you saw stuff like this too, right? 870 pages. But part of my exercise in bringing this up again, as we have discussed in this committee earlier, if you haven't can't tell yet, I am painting myself into a corner so that next year this stuff doesn't happen anymore. And by this stuff, I don't mean the individual provisions that are in this bill or the direction it's going, but this is a really crummy way to make laws. And we have a multi-decade trend in the state. It goes back under both Democrat and Republican control. You can't blame one party. It's clearly both sides, where we are having more and more decisions being made through this. We are having more and more decisions being made through this consolidation. Again, it's not a criticism of you, Representative Liebling, nor you, Representative Schultz. Both sides have done it. But in 2023, we are going to change this. This stuff needs to stop. So, I thoroughly reviewed every page of this bill, this delete all last night. So a question for both Representative Liebling and for Representative Schultz. If there was a single appropriation in this bill that you were able to pull out and have travel by itself, independent of what the Senate is doing, what the governor would do, can you highlight for me what you think would be the highest priority for an item that would be traveling by itself? Just straight appropriation, if both authors could answer that. Thank you.
Let's start with Chair Liebling.
No, can't. They're all important. Some, of course, are more important than others, but no, I couldn't pull one out. You know, we've had this discussion before, Representative Garofalo, and articles are being written about it now, but news articles. But what I would say is that Health and Human Services has always gone together. And this is not like, you know, some of those other bills where you've had, you know, three disparate things stuck together for ease of processing. This stuff does go together because a lot of this is about our system. Now, we had separate committees for health and for human services, but quite frankly, there's really no good way to divide things. We did that to line up more with the Senate, and it worked pretty well because Chair Schultz and I work closely together, but we have one appropriations article in the bill between our two pieces. And then Chair Pinto was, you know, with early childhood, kind of struggling to where his, how his works with ours and with education. So, you know, all the divisions are arbitrary in this area. So I don't think that the criticism fits here, frankly, because this is really the only way we've ever done it. And Chair Petersburg was talking about being before my committee. Well, I was Health and Human Services Finance at that time. And then Chair Moran was Policy at that time. So we split it up that way, Finance and Policy. And that really didn't work that well either. But that's how we used to do it here in the House. So these are not issues like when you put ag together with housing. This is all together. So no, I can't pick anything out that should go separately.
Representative Schultz.
Well, thank you for that question. They are all priorities. And the bill is large because there are a lot of priorities in our state. And the bill is also large because if you change one word and that section of the statute could be six pages, but you're changing one word. And so all of the language stays with that section. Yes, it's unfortunate that we have to carry around an 870-page bill, but they're all priorities. It's very difficult and time-consuming. We try to process and hear as many bills as possible because people are carrying good ideas to provide the services that people need in the state. And so we divided the committee this way to hear more bills, to hear about the needs, to take testimony from the public, and to do the work that we're here to do. And this is the work that we're here to do, and we work really hard in HHS. The HHS team spends a lot of time in committee, hearing bills, taking testimony, putting together the HHS bill. It's a lot of work. And I know my Republican colleagues will agree with that. We spend a lot of time, and we're not done, because we're going to be negotiating with the Senate, who brought a much smaller bill to the Senate and heard many fewer bills in public in committee. So, you know, I don't think we should complain about the size of the bill or combining Health and Human Services. Most of the bills we hear have an appropriation.
Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and to both authors, thank you very much for responding that way. Last year in the state of Minnesota, we passed 31 laws. Everything was contained in 31 separate vehicles. That's the worst we've ever done. And again, I'll say this again because I think sometimes we focus on the polarization aspect of this in parties, is that that is not a criticism of Democrats, because 2 years or 4 years earlier, when Republicans had the House and Senate, you can make the same argument. We continue to, or it's not like government's getting smaller and we're making fewer decisions. We're seeing fewer and fewer chapters of law get passed every single year. And what if we don't change this? And Madam Chair, I do appreciate you allowing me to kind of stray a little bit from the purview of this committee. But if we don't change this, we're going to end up like Washington, D.C. Okay? And what they do out there, they don't even pretend to do their job anymore. Right? They don't even bother. They put everything into one bill. They got three or four people that essentially make all the decisions. Members come on bended knee and beg to the leadership to include their provision in these ginormous bills. And that's the direction that we're heading. Representative Liebling and Representative Schultz, you guys have an impossible job, right? They give you a certain amount of resources, and we say, tell us how much more money you want to spend on the elderly versus the disabled. And within the disabled community, how much money are we going to spend on this condition versus a separate condition, which are both equally tragic. Sometimes these conditions are people making their own, they're making poor life decisions. Other people were just born with these conditions or had very bad luck. So that is not a criticism of you. I'm simply saying that this process has to change. Next year it's going to change. I am burning the bridge behind me, so there's no escape route for me to ever say that it's going to do anything other different. That's my concern. I've never served on a Health and Human Services Committee, thank God. Okay? It is extraordinarily complex. Thank you for the work that you and all your staff do. I'm just saying that other states are able to figure out a way to do this. What we're doing in Minnesota is broken. And this is just a very easy, you know, it's an easy target, right? It's 860 pages. If you complain to people about a 100-page bill, it doesn't get their attention. But when you get this 870-page thing, which I'm sure there are both really good things and crummy things in here, but that's that. So if I could just pivot to another item. So the target for this bill, substantial increase, $700 million plus the $150 million of
preventing homelessness, which is included in the target. This is on top of a pretty extraordinary increase in your target last year's budget compared to the previous biennium. Do either of you have concerns about the fact that the Health and Human Services in the state spending has been and continues to be growing faster than the rate of inflation, growing faster than the rate of population growth, growing faster than the tax revenue that we are taking in to pay for our government? Do either of you have concerns about that, and can you offer solutions that don't involve, give any solutions other than us spending more money?
Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Grafflo, and you and I came into the legislature the same year. I know you called that being litter mates, which is a very uncomfortable term for me. But I appreciate your concerns. I would first like to counter your assumption in your comment that you're going to be in charge here. I don't see that happening, but okay, you know, but I do want to offer that I, of course, see some of the same concerns that you do, and as members who've been here now a while, I would love to work with you, no matter who's in charge, to try to fix some of those concerns, and I don't think that just focusing on how many bills is the right way, but I'd love to talk with you about that. Now, to your actual question, you know, we have in this country, an extraordinarily inefficient system for healthcare. Extraordinarily inefficient. We base it on insurance, which is an extraordinarily inefficient way to finance and deliver health care. And there are things in this bill that attempt to get at that. Now, you may not disagree with the direction they look, but there are studies in this bill to try to get our arms around that, because you are right. The cost of health care is growing. We don't have really great ways of, obviously, our whole system of financing, for example, services for people with disabilities is extraordinarily complex. And when we, the legislators, can't even understand, I mean, Representative Miller says he's not smart. You know, we, the people who are here elected, we are, I always think, if we can't understand what's being done, there is something wrong with the way it's being done, because ordinary human beings who apply themselves should be able to understand this stuff with a little effort. And if we can't, there is a problem, and it's not us, right? So, you know, we do need a lot of reform, and I am concerned. And in this bill is an interesting provision. If I just indulge me for one second, I know the time is running here, but there's a provision that I'm particularly interested in, which allows people in our public healthcare programs, which right now we run most of them through managed care organizations. Everyone should probably know around this table we pay a capitated rate to managed care, and then they take care of, so a person who goes on medical assistance essentially goes into an insurance product, which then manages their care. Well, there's a provision in this bill that says that that person has a choice of whether to go on managed care or just go directly into the fee-for-service program. Interestingly, doing that saves us lots of money. There's a savings on this spreadsheet from allowing people to have that choice. Why? Because managed care is expensive. And we've been doing this for like 25 years. So this, I'm just raising this as an example.
Sure.
Of things we need to look at, and the problem is when you try to make changes, and I'm sure this is true, even more true in Congress, right? The lobbyists descend, the special interests descend, and we as members have to make common cause to not let that happen, to not let it be about, you know, any special interests. The special interests we represent are the people of Minnesota. And I think if we did that, and if we tried to put our ideologies aside and just look at, really try to look at the costs, we can begin to get our arms around some of that. Now, we can't do it completely because a lot of it is driven from national stuff. We do a lot in this bill to try to get our arms around drug costs, which are a huge part of the inflation in healthcare. And it's really hard because states don't have that many levers, frankly. The national government has a lot more levers. But our drug costs are just out of sight, and that's not the way it is around the world. So, yes, I'm concerned about that. And, yes, there are a lot of things we could try to do, but we can't do it if we, you know, let ourselves be divided by lobbyists. You know, I mean, I don't want to lump all the lobbyists in the same, you know, category, but you know what I mean. There are special interests. And everybody, when you try to cut something, somebody is there to tell you, oh, no, you're destroying the world by making that cut. So we really need, yes, we need to get our arms around that, absolutely, and make sure that we are only representing the people of Minnesota, what we believe is really in their best interest. Chair Schultz.
Well, Representative Garofalo, you're asking a health economist if they care about health care cost growth. Yes, I do. One of the reasons I ran for office is to understand what's driving our healthcare cost increases over time and to tackle that problem. And in this bill, there's a provision that I worked on that establishes a health affordability board, and it looks at the increases in healthcare costs in our state over time, and it creates a board to set benchmark targets, growth rate targets. And this has been successful in other states. Massachusetts saved $9 billion over 5 years by implementing something very similar. So this is model legislation. I've been working with other states and the Milbank Memorial Fund to do this. It's in the bill. Unfortunately, the Chamber of Commerce, I think, is opposed to this provision or part of it, although Representative Schumacher and Representative Upke have a similar bill that does a little bit of the flavor of the Health Affordability Board. But I really do think it can be nonpartisan, that we can actually implement that if we don't listen to a lot of the healthcare providers that don't want the targets. All it does, it sets a target, and if they don't meet the target, if they go over that target, they just have to submit a report to show us, legislators, why their costs went up so dramatically. That's what it does. So this provision is in the bill. The other provision that I worked on is the biosimilar provision to get more competition among very expensive drugs that people depend on for their lives. Get more competition with the biosimilars, which are generics of the biologic drugs. So there's provisions in here that I hope that you will look at and support, and we can get over the finish line. Because you're right. If we don't get our healthcare costs under control, it's going to bankrupt not just the state, but it's going to have implications across the country in every state. And people won't be able to afford to get healthcare. I mean, people who have insurance functionally are not insured because they can't afford their cost sharing, their deductibles, or their co-payments. So it is a big problem.
And Madam Chair, Representative Liebling and Schultz, thank you for those answers. You know, Representative Albright will be doing the closing on our side, and I know this has been a longer conversation. We've gone a little bit from the purview of this committee. I do appreciate it, but
we're still on a DE1 amendment.
Yes, but Madam Chair, I do think it's important to recognize that when you have expenditures that for multiple years, multiple sessions, regardless of policy changes, are growing faster than the private sector economy is that pays for it, right? Now, we can dispute what are the best ways to stop that growth, right? And containing healthcare costs is a super complex and personal issue for people, right? Especially as Representative Liebling, let's be honest, the profit motive gets involved in here, okay? People make money off delivering healthcare, and I'm a free market dude too. And not that you're a dude, but I mean, I'm a free market person as well. So you offended the stepchildren, and now I'm calling you a dude. So even now, but that overall issue, it's a huge problem. And my primary concern is that we're going to reach a point here where bankruptcy isn't going to happen. I don't think that'll happen, but at some point here, the employer-based healthcare model, businesses are just going to raise up their hands and they're going to say, tell us about this single-payer thing, because they're just not going to want the responsibility of it. Now, I understand that from your perspective, maybe you're cool with that. Maybe you think that that's okay? I don't like that. So I don't want to speak for everyone on our side of the aisle, but in the back of our minds, whenever we're seeing dramatic increases in costs, whenever we're seeing the system getting more broken, we can't help but wonder if sometimes smart people are deliberately doing this to move us towards a single-payer healthcare model. I'm not saying that you're doing that, but when you take a look at things like MNsure and the fact that we've developed our own exchange here, then that's where the mindset is coming from. And that's what the concern is with the spending. Representative Albright will do the closing on our side. I can see Representative Liebling is going to rebut me on the point. But I want you to understand that's the dialogue, right? And I do want to come back to where I started on this. I do believe that we are better served, and Minnesotans are better served, by having a more decentralized decision-making process and more individual bills going through the process. Both parties are to blame for that, but I think that the act of just pulling these individual bills out, as you said earlier this week, the minority party has a responsibility to not obstruct and delay and to force the majority party to consolidate things together. I think that's an important part for getting to solutions. So you're going to get the last word on this, and then Albright will close, but I just wanted to let you both know what I think about that. So thanks.
I'm going to go to Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Don't you wish every day was HHS Day?
No.
It is.
No.
Members, I've often said in committee, and I first want to recognize the work that Chair Pinto, Chair Liebling, and Chair Schultz have put forth in this bill. This is, based upon the crowd in the room and based upon the conversations around this table, you get a small glimpse into the appreciation and the overwhelming sense of urgency that we as members hear on a daily basis for the system that we call Health and Human Services in the state. I'm reminded of a very, very old analogy. Sometimes it's like dealing with flubber. You can't hold it. You can't attach it. You can't box it up. It is amorphous. And I think that's what we're talking about with regard to the HHS bill. You know, we often are reminded of the three different groups of people that we have to remind ourselves that we are beholden to every time we meet. To the people that are in the dawn of life, to the people that are in the twilight of their life. But as we've just been talking about, the group that really struggles to be heard sometimes, and and that's why I think that you've heard the conversation around the table, at least from this side, are those that are in the shadows of life. And they struggle, just like everyone else, and even more so, with making every day their best day. And Chair Schultz and I have had numerous conversations, and we're both readers, and we've shared a number of books on this subject. And while we don't always agree, we do put forward what we think is in the best interests from each perspective, the state of Minnesota. It's a balance. It's a balance between needs and wants. It's a balance between investments and reforms. It's recognizing that we're dealing with not only with families, but communities and individuals that are struggling to be heard. I heard the analogy of everyone, you know, we need to watch out for the interest groups when they descend. We all are special interest groups. If it's not for ourselves, if it's not for our communities, I mean, we were elected to represent a special interest group. It's our district. So I think as we move forward, and I don't have any comments other than what hasn't been said, and I share those in terms of the due diligence on this bill. There will be more than ample opportunity to discuss the provisions in this bill on the floor and as we move it in the committee. And I know Representative Schumacher shares his desire to be a part of that program as we move it off the floor and into conversations with the other body. But I will leave you with this. We are looking for reforms. We are looking for investments that make sense. And it is in the balance that I right now encourage my side of the aisle to vote no as we move this bill forward. Is it perfect? No. Is it a good bill? In ways, yes. Can it be made better? I hope that we can accomplish that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. And thank you to everyone. This has been a really, really good discussion on an issue that is huge. I know as chair, when I was chair of Health and Human Service Policy Committee, you know, there was many times people look to us and call us Health and Human Services. Why would you want to be on that? Because the need is so great. But I also know in being around a lot of national conversations that there are so many other states that look to Minnesota for the work that we have done in this area. I hear it and I see it all the time. But that goes without saying the need is great and there's still so much more that we need to do to care for people, to make real people's lives, healthy lives better. There's so much that we can do, we have done, and need to continue to do. And unfortunately, there is no easy way around that. So, seeing no further discussion, questions on the DE1 amendment as amended, I would like to go to a vote. So, all those who are in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. So, we have Senate File 4410 before us. So the next vote will be the final vote on the combined package. I want to go to a vote, but I'm also feeling this obligation to ask the chair. So do you have any closing comments?
Madam Chair, I just want to thank everyone and, you know, thank our Republican colleagues as well. Thank you, Representative Albright, for that very nice closing comment. And thank you for all the members who've spoken and for the good discussion. Really appreciate it. And look forward to your partnership as we move forward and try to do the best for the state. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. We good? So the next vote that you will be the final vote on the combined package. So Chair Liebling renews her original motion that Senate File 4410, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. Ms. Anna, please take the roll on the vote.
Chair Moran.
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright.
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen, excused. Representative Hassan.
Oh, I'm here. I'm here. Yes.
Representative Hansen.
Yes, I got here, so yes.
Okay.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan.
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas, excused. Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson.
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Crenshaw.
Crenshaw, no.
Crenshaw, no. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly.
Aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani.
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt.
Aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller.
No.
Miller, no. Representative Nash.
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Knorr. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski, no. Representative Petersburg?
No.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Bernardi. And Representative Noor. Madam Chair, that is 15 ayes and 11 nays.
So there have been 15 ayes and 11 nays. The motion prevails. Senate File 4410, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register, and the nonpartisan staff are directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. I want to thank all the chairs and your committee for your work and your dedication in a field, in an area that is really hard and tough to really do great things for people and people's lives, and for putting together this important work. Thank you so much. And so I'm going to pass this over to Vice Chair Olson to gather in the last bill on the agenda.
All right, so the last bill on the agenda will move separately. So Chair Marquardt, you have House File 3669, the Omnibus Tax Bill. And so Chair Marquardt, please move your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to move House File 3669 to be placed on the general register.
Very good, Chair Marquardt. And you also have an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like. Would you also like to move the A23 amendment?
Very good, Madam Chair and members. I would like to move the A23 amendment. And members, to the simplicity of a tax bill now, after all that you've heard. So,
proceed, Chair Marquardt.
So there are a number of basically technical provisions in the A23 amendment. View suggested by Department of Revenue, technical. We've replaced a couple blank appropriations to zero. We changed one administrative one back to 2.5%. I see Representative Nash is gone right now. And then there's one that has a bit of a fiscal impact, is dealing with the Great Start child care credit and how we do the phase-in. Actually, it's about $300,000 to the good. So that is, and I see folks shaking their head on the finance area. So that is the amendment I'd like, if members would approve, to get the bill into the shape I'd like to see it.
Very good. So we have the A23 in front of us. Any discussion to the A23 author's amendment? All right. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 All those
aye.
Opposed, please say no.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So House File 3669, as amended, is before us. So Chair Marquardt, please continue with your presentation.
So, well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is a strong bipartisan bill that's going to make a real meaningful and prominent impact on the lives of our senior citizens and our families. And on top of that, is going to propose the largest property tax cuts in over 20 years. On top of that, we also look at how we can help workers and small businesses that were most impacted by the pandemic. And we also address the workforce shortage needs and also affordable housing as some of the bigger areas in the bill. And before I go into more of the details, I'd like to offer some huge thanks. First of all, thank you to our nonpartisan staffs who have so much input in helping put something like this together. I want to thank the Tax Committee, and there are six members on the Ways and Means that also serves on the Tax Committee. It's an excellent committee, and this is a product of their of the efforts of the Tax Committee. And I also have Chair Joachim, who is also in the audience here, who was a leader on the property tax provisions in this bill and chaired the property tax division. So I mentioned this is a bipartisan bill. There's at least 24 GOP member provisions in the bill. That's at least one provision for the GOP every 11.33 pages in the bill. The target is $1.645 billion in this biennium. So I want to kind of break it up. So This bill says to families, young families, that we understand the joys you have with raising your children. We also understand the challenges you have where you're probably going to have the highest cost you ever will have in your life. Child care costs, student loan debt, mortgage or rent costs, property taxes. And so this bill makes significant cuts and enhancements to our young families. So let me just go over some of those provisions. The Great Start Child Care Credit will provide up to a $3,000 child care credit for any from birth to the age of four. You'll notice a number of the things in this tax bill enhances kind of a lot of these other bills you've heard along the way. And that will, like I said, provide up to $3,000 for one child, up to $6,000 for two, and up to $7,500 credit for three or more children. We also raise the phase out from $55,000 to $125,000. This will get out to about 186,000 families. Something else we do is the student loan credit. We have tripled basically that, moving the maximum from $500 to a $1,400 credit for student loans. And we've also made the credit refundable instead of non-refundable. The third impact we have for families is a child tax credit rebate. So it's going to go out very similar to what Governor Walz is doing. These checks would go out this summer, early fall, as soon as possible. And what it would provide is a $325 rebate to every dependent under the age of 17. And that's about a $300 million cost. We also have upped the income levels for the K-12 credit. So for senior citizens, we tell senior citizens that we understand that any cost we can cut for you is very important. But also just as important, we want to make sure that you can maintain your independence, which means staying in the home that you raised your family in, and now you have your grandchildren coming in for Christmas and so forth, and also make sure you've got a good health care system when things, when you need that. So we do two primary things for senior citizens. One is we significantly cut the taxes on Social Security benefits. We say basically if you're married, joint filer at $75,000 income or less, you will not pay a dime on your Social Security benefits. And if you're a single, it's $58,600. In reality, because of the way the formula works, it actually means it's about $85,000. So if you're a senior couple, each getting about $18,000 in Social Security, which is $36,000, you can actually have an additional almost $50,000 additional income on top of that, and all of your Social Security benefits will be tax-free. And that's that will benefit almost a quarter of a million senior citizens. That's $114 million a year and an average tax cut of about $470. The second thing that we'll get into are the huge property tax cuts for seniors that we'll get into. So for workers and small businesses who have suffered from the pandemic, we do the subtraction for the unemployment insurance like we did last year's bill. It's one time, subtraction up to $10,200 for both either federal and or state unemployment insurance. So it'll get out to over 500,000 people. And then we have small business grants. So all of those grants and forgivable loans that businesses have gotten, there's been like 11 programs since the beginning of COVID-19. Those state and local dollars are actually taxable. And I've actually heard from a few businesses. We provide a subtraction for that. So that those dollars they received will not be taxable. That's about $20 million. And there's $50 million that would go to businesses most impacted. And then we also do the federal conformity, which is about $75 million of tax cuts for businesses. I want to talk about the property taxes and then give you a few examples. I'm sure many of you have heard about the huge spike in market values. Statewide, on residential properties, they're going up 19%. On ag land, 15%. On apartments, it's 10%. It's huge. This proposal we have in this tax bill will provide the biggest property tax cuts in over 20 years since the 2001 reform. And it's the right way to do it because it is direct dollars that go directly to property taxpayers, over $250 million permanent a year. The big way in which we do this is by moving the renter's refund to a renter's credit on the income tax form as it was prior to 1981. Now instead of having to wait 9 months, folks will be able to get that credit early on. That is about $150 million a year. And the other thing we do is at that time is you move from a household income for that to adjusted gross income. And the big thing on that is right now seniors have to count their non-taxable Social Security. Let me give you one example. So you've got a couple that are bringing in $36,000 of Social Security. And let's say they earn $5,000 or $10,000 on top of that. Doesn't matter. They are living primarily off their Social Security. They pay no taxes on their Social Security. So any bill that's going to exempt Social Security isn't going to help them one bit. But they now can exclude that $36,000 off their income for their renter's credit. So their income goes from $46,000 or whatever down to $10,000. That, on the average, is going to bring in a roughly $900 for those seniors living off Social Security, $900 of increased renter's credit aid. That is huge. And so this gets out to about 88,000 seniors. We know on our renters, those who get the renter's credit, 30% are seniors or those with disabilities. And in 14 rural counties in the state, it's 50% or more are seniors. We know that single-parent households, 46% of those are rentals. Other property tax items, we up the homestead credit state refund, $36 million a year. Remember, these are direct. We have $50 million a year in school equalization, direct property tax aid. We also increase local government aid by $34 million a year, county program aid by $13,000. And one thing we're expanding, if you remember the agriculture, the ag to school credit, we're on school bonds. We had upped that back in 2019. Well, initially it was put in the 2017 bill at 40%. We upped it to 70. This will take it in payable 24 from 70 up to 85%. It would make that permanent. You know, there's some other things we do on housing and so forth, but I just want to close with a couple real-life examples. So, you know, you mentioned all the stuff in the bill, but how would it really impact? I'm trying to take averages here. So you've got a family of four. They've got one child who's 3 years old and let's say one who's eight. They make $125,000. They have a $425,000 home in Minnetonka. What are they going to qualify under our bill? They're going to get the $3,000 child care credit. They're going to get $650 on the one-time rebate. And they'll get $165 of increased increased refund on the homestead credit state refund. That's over $3,800. And that's not including, and by the way, that's a 54% income tax cut, just the $3,000. That's 54% income tax cut. And that's not including if they qualify for a student loan credit, which could go up to $1,400. That's really significant. I want to go to seniors. You got a couple, married seniors, each of them getting about $18,000 on Social Security at $36,000. And they live in a Edina in a $275,000 home. They are going to get all of their Social Security benefits are exempt. That's going to be $848 of cut. That's a 51% income tax cut. And on top of that, they're going to get about $101 in the homestead credit state refund, about a 3% cut on their property taxes. That's over $900. One other senior. Let's go to a single senior with a $50,000 income, $18,000 in Social Security, pretty average, and is renting a one-bedroom apartment in Fergus Falls at $700 a month. All of their Social Security is going to be exempt. That's going to be about $367 cut, 28% on their income tax. Plus, they're going to get about $147 in an increase in their renter's credit. This bill is significant in what it produces for folks. And just to close, is that there's a real balance to this bill in that we're talking about $1.645 billion. But what it allows is that it allows for all of these other areas that you've heard prior to this bill, the huge investment, important investment in education or health care, child care, public safety. It allows that to occur. And this bill really enhances and complements much of that. But the focus is on our families and our seniors, on our workers, our small businesses. How can we make a real difference that are going to very positively impact people? So with that, Madam Chair, I know I just to kind of understand what's in this, I felt I had to go over a little detail. So thanks for your indulgence, Madam Chair and committee.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. So we do have some pre-filed amendments. So we are going to move to those now. And Representative Garofalo, you're withdrawing your amendment. So we just have the one remaining amendment, which is the Sundin amendment. So we'll go to the A22-0435. So Representative Sundin, please move your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So move that amendment.
Great. So would you describe your amendment too, please, Representative Sundin?
Yes, thank you, the Madam Chair. The amendment addresses what I think is a misstep in previous tax code that allows for pretty much unlimited levy authority to fire districts, and it's caused some real concerns right in my own township in up in Carrollton County, and this addresses the concerns of the citizens in Thompson Township, and I hope I can have support. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Marquardt, comments on the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sundin, for bringing that forward. And we've talked about this quite a bit, and I've said no before, and I respectfully will ask members to vote no on this, Representative Sundin. I just think we did create the fire districts last year, and at this point, I just don't want to carve one specific one out at this point. So I'd ask members to please vote no.
Thank you. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Miller.
Madam Chair, it's not to this amendment.
Okay, to the bill. Okay, great. Any further discussion on the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say no.
No.
No. The amendment the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So we have no further amendments, so we'll move to discussion to the bill as amended. So, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Marquardt, just first, I want to say that I served on your committee for 2 years, and it not only has it been a pleasure, but I would recommend that any member, whether you're interested in taxes or not, should try to get on that committee at some point. It is so educational. You learn a significant part of, we kind of talk about in all these other committees, are in the end all affected by the taxes that we do or don't pay. And it really helped me understand not only our tax system, but how the rest of our state is reflected off of that. It took me 2 years, plus all this time going through this omnibus bill, to finally realize a question that I probably could have asked before, but I really want to know. And it has to do with the renter's credit and the skyrocketing property taxes. So if you could help me understand the math on this, or not the math, you'll understand. So the renters get their credit, and I assume it's the presumption is that because they live on the property, they're paying the property taxes, so they should get the credit. But I just realized that the property owners are still probably paying that skyrocketing property taxes that you're talking about. Since it isn't really affecting the property tax that's being charged locally, it's just the people who are paying it. So I think you understand my question. Yeah. Are the property owners still paying those skyrocketing property taxes?
Madam Chair, Representative Miller, yeah, that's a great question. They are, and that's why they need to pass it on to their renters. And so the assumption is in the state of Minnesota that 17% of the rent you pay is going towards property taxes. And so then at the end of the year, they have to get a certificate of rent paid from the apartment owner saying, yeah, this is how much you paid in rent, and they calculate 17%. But yes, I mean, right now on apartments, as I said, the values are going up about 10%. So that is just the value. Now that doesn't equate, of course, into a property tax increase necessarily. That's determined by tax levies at the end. But whatever the increase might be, is assumed it would be passed on to the renter.
Representative Miller.
So just one more short question, just to clarify then. So the way the formula is written up is it's a direct pass on. So I'm going to keep the math simple. If on a property they're paying $50,000 in property taxes, the owners of the land, the tenants, based off of your formula, basically it passes through to that $50,000. It's an even match that passes through.
Chairman Court.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Miller. So if there's an increase of 50,000 property taxes and you had 20 units or something, whatever that probably not a good example, but that's whatever, that would equate an extra $500 per unit,
right,
would probably get passed into a monthly rental increase. I mean, that's the assumption that is being made. And so the owner would be able to recoup through the increase in the rent, and the renter would be able to recoup through the property tax or the renter's credit.
Okay, Madam Chair, just one final comment on that, and this is probably stepping into years of tax policy in the state of Minnesota, but I would think that the direct passing on to the property owners would be a more accurate reflection of a property tax cut. I'm just concerned that this formula, the way it plays out and what I hear from property owners, is that it makes sense, but I don't know that it's necessarily reflective of what's really going on. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Johnson.
Chair Schultz, Chair Marquardt, the question I have is similar to the issue on the property tax, changing it this way. You said you use the example of a $500 increase per unit in an apartment complex. But we have cities now that have instituted maximum rent increases. The property tax could go up much higher than what's allowed for the rent to go up. In those circumstances, where the would be an automatic going to the renter, although they did not pay the increase, how would that work when the actual owner of the property had to pay that increase, but the renters didn't have to pay their share of it?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, all I can answer to that is that the certificate of rent paid is only what was actually paid by the renter. So there had been questions that came up, like if you'd received renter's assistance, that would not qualify. It's only what they actually paid. And so ever how that would work out with the owner on, what was paid, that's all that this renter's refund or credit would reflect, is what actually was paid in cash or some other way by the renter. I don't know if that answered your question, Representative Johnson, but that
question,
it depends on what the renter has paid in rent, and it's 17% of that.
Representative Johnson, anything more?
No, thank you.
Representative Graffel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I just leaned over to my colleague, Representative O'Neill, and I said, man, Representative Marquardt is so smooth. The way he just glossed over that question there, I was like, well, the property owner's paying the property taxes, and we're still going to give the money to the renter. That's all I can really say about it. So that was good. Representative Marquardt, a similar question to what I asked Representative Liebling and Schultz earlier. Obviously, we have a history of having very few tax bills. Everything gets lumped together. If you could highlight one or two provisions that if you had the option of traveling by itself, what would you say would be those items that you think would be of the highest priority?
So, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo. So I don't really want to show my hand for the conference committee, but You know, one thing when you're putting a bill together like this, so I could say, you know, a high priority, I'm going to say, right, you know, is the renter's credit. That's a big priority. But to just do that, you're missing other areas on trying to create a balance, whether or not it's geographically or income or equity or whatever that might be. By just putting one bill out at a time, unless you knew they were all going to pass, you just kind of lose that balance, which is always when members look at things as a bill, they're looking at the balance. And so I wouldn't be able to give you any specific one just because I do think there has to be balance in these bills, which necessitates us to have several provisions. Would we have to have all of these? Could some of them run separately? Certainly they probably could, but to keep a balance, you'd have to have a certain amount of bills in an omnibus bill.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt. On the spreadsheet that were put out, on line two, it shows tax policy revenue, and it shows for the biennium what anticipated revenue is under House file, under your bill as amended. Can you or nonpartisan staff tell us what the revenue numbers, not what the fiscal impact is on the general fund, but what the revenue numbers are without any changes, what the base numbers are? And the point I'm getting to is that there's a difference between tax reduction that is actually lowering the tax that people are paying in the government versus credits, set-asides, and I don't mean it in a pejorative way, redistribution, where we do that. Do we know, can you or nonpartisan staff tell us what those baseline numbers are for fiscal year 22-23 as well as 24-25?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. Ms. Templin, always to the rescue.
Ms. Templin, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff, if I could direct you to the spreadsheet on page 5. If I understand the question correctly, the question is what are the total current law general fund tax revenues in fiscal 22 and 23? And you can see on line 148 of the spreadsheet, as Representative Garofalo pointed out, there's $54,594,416,000. The fiscal 22-23 biennium compared to the previous biennium, the growth in the general fund tax revenue is 14.3%. And moving further, that's just the current law increase in general fund revenues. With the changes in House File 3669 as amended, the general fund revenues, the growth compared to the previous biennium shows up on line 152 of the spreadsheet on page 5, and that is 11.27% in the fiscal 22-23 biennium.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. And I'll just remind members, we have like about a minute left before we're slated to be done. We can go a couple of minutes over if we think we can wrap up. Otherwise, we'll recess. So Representative Garofalo and Nash on the list. So we'll see if we can get it done in a couple minutes here. So Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Ms. Templin, I just want to make sure that I understand what that number means. So we're looking at line 151, and it's described as non-dedicated tax revenue plus House File 3669 total, all change items. That is the tax revenue, and I don't want to use the term net because it's not, but that is the tax revenue. I can take that and subtract it from line 148, and that will actually tell me the amount of tax reductions that are taking place in this bill.
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, if I'm understanding your question correctly, yes, it on line 148 of this spreadsheet, that shows the current law general fund tax revenues. On line 151 of this spreadsheet, that shows the current law general fund tax revenues with the general fund changes in tax revenues from the bill. And if you subtracted line 148 from line 152, you would get a total change in tax revenues of the amount that is on line 6 of the spreadsheet of $1,477,230,000.
Madam Chair, Ms. Teplin and Representative Marquardt, obviously my definition of tax relief, Representative Marquardt would say that tax credits, additional local government aid, those are all forms of tax relief. I'm saying from the revenue side of things, money that's going into the government mixing bowl, that's what I'm looking at. So thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Templin, as always, thank you. And thank you, Representative Marquardt.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Marquardt, Chair Marquardt, we had talked about taxes being able to be spread to renters through all of that effort. But isn't it true that in a rent-controlled area that that's not possible? You know, we've got several cities that have now voted for rent control, and that precludes the building owner from being able to do that. Isn't that correct?
Chair Marquardt.
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, I don't know for sure enough about the rent control, quite honestly.
Once again, Chair Marquardt being Nash. Very smooth. well, members, it's true. If there's a tax that gets spread to other renters in other places, that's because they don't have rent control. But in a rent control area, that's not possible. So I find that very unfortunate. Once again, rent control is a dangerous area. I think that many on my side would agree with that. But just wanted to make sure that we put that on the record, because we were talking about rent and taxes being able to be passed along to renters. With rent control, not possible. Thank you.
Seeing that there's no more discussion, I'll go back to Chair Marquardt for a closing last word.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Just one clarification. When I'm talking about the 17% of the taxes, that is what the property taxes are. They still have to go through a formula, so it's not a direct payment. They have a copay and a threshold and so forth. But members, this is, like I said, a very good, strong, bipartisan bill that are really going to help folks around the state. So appreciate your indulgence today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt, for all of your work. Great presentation and a great bill. And so we have the Marquardt motion before us that House File 3669, as amended, be recommended for placement on the general register, and that nonpartisan staff be directed to make any technical corrections and amend the title. So Ms. Anna, please take the roll.
Chair Moran.
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo.
Garofalo, no.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright.
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker Finn.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi. Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan.
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas, excused. Representative Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Crenshaw?
Crenshaw, no.
Crenshaw, no. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly,
aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
No.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pulaski? Representative Petersburg?
No.
Representative Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Bernardi. And Representative Pulaski.
Pulaski's excused.
Pulaski excused. Madam Chair, that is 16 ayes and 10 nays.
On a vote of 16 ayes and 10 nays, the motion prevails and House File 3669, as amended, is onto the floor. And so members,
thank you,
that concludes, thank you, Chair Marquardt. Members, that concludes our work for today. We are back tomorrow at 9 a.m. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.